Tomorrow, of course, is Independence Day. You know, in the past, and I think I've shared this before with the beginning of messages for the 4th of July, in the past, the 4th of July has been associated with such things as freedom, patriotism, and independence. But today, about the only thing that people associate with this great American holiday is fireworks, baseball games, and picnics. Few indeed give any thought to the real meaning, to the previous slavery, to the freedom secured, and to the tremendous price that was paid. The question I want to address in this message is, why is that? What's happened in America that the holiday, this particular holiday, no longer has the meaning it once did? Well, there are several, I believe there are several different reasons for it. In this particular message, I want to share at least a few of them with you. For one thing, time. Over 200 years have separated us now from that monumental historical day when America declared her independence. And time tends to fade the memory, especially when more than one generation passes by. Unless, of course, the great-grandfathers, grandfathers, and fathers are especially diligent to pass on the stories, the legends, the battles, the victories, and the history onto each and every succeeding generation. Because you see, when the gun smoke has cleared, when the gunpowder no longer fills the nostrils, when the scars of battle and victory can no longer be seen or touched, and when a countryside scene no longer floods one's memory as if they were there experiencing it all over again. In other words, when the generation that experienced it all has passed on, time tends to make all fade away and be forgotten. Now, it doesn't have to, but time does have that disposition. So for the generation who has experienced the actual events and paid the price, it takes great diligence on their part to ensure that all is not lost in the succeeding generations. That's, of course, one of the reasons why we have holidays, why we have songs written about those events, and why we have history books. You know, God knew that this was the case, and so when it came to some of the important events in Israel's past, He instructed, He warned them specifically regarding this. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 4. Deuteronomy chapter 4, where we find a previous event in Israel's history very similar to the one we're discussing here in America. It was when Israel, in a sense, was declaring her independence at an earlier time as well, the time when she was taking possession of her first promised land. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 4, and I want to read just two verses to begin. Deuteronomy 4, and beginning with verse 1. And there we find these words. It says, "And now, O Israel, listen to the statutes and the judgments which I am teaching you to perform, in order that you may live and go in and take possession of the land which Yahweh, the God of your fathers, is giving you." They were going in, again, just as it was in the past, in the 1600s and 1700s, taking over a new land. Very similar. You go back and you examine what took place in the first Canaan land, and you can see why many of our early American historians called this the second Canaan land, because the parallels are absolutely amazing. And why not? We're talking about the same people. First, going into their first promised land, and secondly, going into their second promised land. But it's verse 9 that I want you to look at most particularly. It says, "Only give heed to yourself and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen." Listen again. He says, "Only give heed to yourselves and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, and lest they depart from your heart all the days of your life, but make them known to your sons and your grandsons." God was exhorting Israel, don't let it be forgotten, neither with you, nor with your children or your grandchildren. God didn't want them to forget. However, He knew that they likely would. He knew that once a little time had passed, that once they had got settled in, that once they had began feeling at peace and secure, that once they started reveling in their prosperity and good fortune, that once the generations who didn't pay the price started to take advantage of the blessings secured by those who did, that it was very likely they would forget. Turn to Deuteronomy chapter 8, which deals exactly with those thoughts. Deuteronomy chapter 8, beginning with verse 11. It says, "Beware lest you forget Yahweh your God by not keeping His commandments and His ordinances and His statutes, which I am commanding you today. Lest when you have eaten and are satisfied, and have built good houses and lived in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and gold multiply, and all that you have multiplies, then your heart becomes proud, and you forget Yahweh your God, who brought you out from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." And also verses 17 through 19, where it says, "Otherwise you may say in your heart, my power and the strength of my hand made me this wealth. But you shall remember Yahweh your God, for it is He who is giving you power to make wealth, that He may confirm His covenant which He swore to your fathers, as it is this day. And it shall come about, if you ever forget Yahweh your God, and go after other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you today, that you shall surely perish." Peter Marshall and David Manuel, in the book The Light and the Glory, use this very passage as a springboard to discuss what eventually took place in America, as it did in Israel's past as well, here in the second land of promise. I want to read to you, somewhat lengthy, but I think you'll enjoy, not necessarily enjoy, but it'll be interesting reading as I read a part of this, again, what is based on that passage we just read. In The Light and the Glory, Peter Marshall and David Manuel together researched and wrote this. It says, "And this was exactly," speaking of that passage, "what was beginning to happen in God's new Israel, just one generation after the arrival of the first comers. For faith was not something that could be passed on from generation to generation or imparted by baptism or the partaking of Holy Communion. In order for faith to come to flower, it must be planted in the soil of gratitude. But being born into town situations instead of having to carve them out of the wilderness, the succeeding generations would not know desperate need. They would grow up never knowing what it meant to be persecuted for one's faith, to be mocked and scorned, or even imprisoned merely because they loved God enough to attempt to put Him and His will before all else. The son of the fathers would never know what it was like to have no land and no work and no say in how they were governed. They would have no indelible memories etched into their minds of 10, 12, 16 weeks of wet misery on the open seas, of living in tents or holes in the ground while cold and sickness took one in two, of starving times which saw them on their hands and knees, looking for ground nuts or grubbing for mussels to stay alive, and all for the sake of their combined faith in the vision of a promised land." You permit me, a second promised land is provided in 2 Samuel 7 and verse 10. "Therefore, they would not be inclined to put all their trust in God. It was by His grace that they and their parents were being blessed. And while they might give lip service to His grace, the truth was that since they had never known anything else, they could hardly share the gratefulness of their parents. And what of those parents? As their common condition of great need gradually shifted to one of decided affluence, was their commitment to the covenant as absolute as it once had been? Or was having more than enough to eat, more than adequate shelter, and more than enough land already beginning to take its toll? How quickly fade the pangs of harder times? Would America's affluence, the very gifts of a loving father in response to the obedience of loving children, dim the light of Christ which had seemed so dazzling? As a homestead of 3 acres became 30 and then 300, would greed replace need? It is also human nature that one generation which has gone through a time of great tribulation will do all in its power to preserve and protect its offspring from the same deprivations. As the Puritan fathers and mothers became wise in the ways of living close to the land, they passed on to their sons and daughters an endless and priceless compendium of frontier knowledge: how to shoe a horse, when the wheat is ready for harvest, the finer points of carding and spinning wool. And if, before each lesson, they forgot to stress the need to pray first and commit it all to God, and to know that it is His grace which was solely responsible for anything turning out well, the golden gift of resourcefulness would transmute itself to the lead of self-reliance. My land, my team of horses, with the might of my hand. As the fathers began to think this way, they raised a generation of strong, well-adapted, and supremely capable and self-reliant Yankees. Really wish I could even read more of it to you, because it really says so much more, but that was lengthy enough. But you can see that it was no different. That the same warning that was needed in the old land of promise was certainly needed in the new land of promise for these new Israelite Puritans as well. And of course, as time has gone on, as each successive generation from those in early America has passed on, it's only gotten worse here in America. Americans have gotten apathetic, and apathy simply breeds more forgetfulness. Yet, time alone is not the only factor that has caused Americans to forget. History books are written, of course, to keep remembrances alive. But what if someone doesn't want you to remember? What if someone doesn't want you to know your history? Knowing that your true history may awaken the sleeping giant within you. That your history may stir your emotions and rouse you to action. Then what? Well, if someone had that in mind, then of course they would do their best to destroy or rewrite your history. Don't ever forget, history is written or rewritten by the conquerors. It's always from the conqueror's perspective. When rewritten, it's called revisionism. Revisionism, by the way, is not necessarily bad in and of itself. It all depends on the motives and the accuracy. However, let me assure you, when it comes to the revision of early American history, it is neither with good motives or accurate. Now, just in case someone might find that hard to believe, let me share with you from the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. And for those in the tape ministry who may be new and may not have ever heard of the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, let me again share with you that they are the minutes from the first Zionist Congress held in Basel, Switzerland in 1897. They're basically the Jewish design for world domination. Let me read to you from Protocol 16, to begin with, Protocol 16, Article 1, Sentence 1, which we find says this: in order to effect the destruction of all collective forces except ours, we shall emasculate the first stage of collectivism, the universities, by re-educating them in a new direction. Article 3, Sentence 2 through Article 4, Sentence 2 reads this way: we must introduce into their education all those principles which have so brilliantly broken up their order. But when we are in power, we shall remove every kind of disturbing subject from the course of education and shall make out of the youth obedient children of authority, loving him who rules as the support and hope of peace and quiet. Classicism, as also any form of study of ancient history, in which there are more bad than good examples, we shall replace with the study of the program for the future. Of course, more bad in their eyes, not necessarily bad. Understand, they're saying bad from their perspective. Again, classicism, as also any form of study of ancient history, in which there are more bad than good examples, we shall replace with the study of the program of the future. I want you to catch that. Notice the enemies of Christianity, how they look to the future. I'm going to end this message how God instructs us to look to the past over and over again. Going on, it says, we shall erase from the memory of men all facts of previous centuries which are undesirable to us, and leave only those which depict all the errors of the government of the Goyim. Now, I might also insert a thought with what I just shared with you. God does indeed help want us to look to the future as well. He has us looking to the future, but it's all based on the past, and that's the difference. Now, for those who may not be familiar, I do now with the protocols. I want to mention that I do have those available now through this ministry as well. Matter of fact, I also have available also on our book list, The Light and the Glory as well. Now, why do you think America's, in light of that, why do you think America's undeniable Christian roots, based on volumes of documentation, is no longer taught in our public schools? Completely void. From the grade schools on through the universities. They just mentioned the universities, but it's now, it's throughout. You cannot find America's undeniable Christian roots being taught today. Why is it? Well, I'll tell you why. Because it's specifically the Christian aspect of our history that revisionists want to revise most. Listen also to Protocol 4, Article 3, Sentence 2 through Article 4, Sentence 2. It says, with such a faith as this, a people might be governed by a wardship of parishes and would walk contentedly and humbly under the guiding hand of its spiritual pastor, submitting to the dispositions of God upon earth. This is the reason why it is indispensable for us to undermine all faith, to tear out of the minds of the goyim the very principle of Godhead and the Spirit, and to put in its place arithmetical calculations and material needs. In order to give the goyim no time to think and take note, their minds must be diverted towards industry and trade. Thus all the nations will be swallowed up in the pursuit of gain, and in the race for it will not take note of their common foe. And isn't that exactly what's been happening right here in America? Even though that was written as far back as 1897. Now, do you think that such a book, or I should say, why do you think such a book as The Light and the Glory is such a rarity today and would never be allowed in American history class, in spite of the fact it's one of the most accurate history books we have available to us today, written in recent history? Well, again, I'll tell you why. It's because someone wants you to forget your history. And by the way, don't think that it's being rewritten only by the secularists. I have an article from the Washington Times, November 23rd, 1992, which is entitled Christian Nation, Now Fighting Words. Here's part of, I'll read part of what it has to say. It begins by saying, by Larry Witham, Washington Times, in 1931, the U.S. Supreme Court noted that the United States is a Christian nation. A little bit later he says, in 1947, writing to Pope Pius XII, President Truman said flatly, this is a Christian nation. Nobody argued with any of them. But a fortnight ago, when Kirk Fordyce, the governor of Mississippi, referred to the United States as a Christian nation, he set off an uproar in the media and in the ranks of his own Republican Party. The label Christian nation has become fighting words. In a nation where a vast majority, 80%, according to U.S. Census Bureau, call themselves Christian, it is no longer politically prudent or culturally chic to speak of a Christian America. Why is that? Well, it's obvious, because a minority rules America. 80% claim to be Christian, but you can't call it a Christian nation. Going on a little bit later, since Mr. Fordyce used the term at a Republican governor's news conference last week, he has been pilloried by liberals, the media, and Jewish leaders, and unbraided by the Republican Party leadership. Quote, one of his quotes, I simply made a clear statement of truth, Mr. Fordyce said later. It has nothing to do with running down anybody else's religion, end of quote. But then notice what it says next. Nevertheless, last Friday, he felt compelled to apologize. Another one bites the dust. I've read other articles throughout over the years of the same men doing the exact same thing, and from the pressure of those of the minority antichrist in this country, they end up biting the dust once again. Going on, I want to get more into this because it's these later quotes that really bring out the point of what I'm saying. That is that don't think that it's only the secularists who are rewriting Christian American history. It's the religionists as well. Following quote, or another quote later on, it says, sorting out what is Christian and what is not in American history is extremely complicated, says Mark Knoll, American church history professor at Wheaton College. Later, in the Department of Independence, there are God-given rights maybe, but inalienable rights means they are there before God. Quote by Mr. Noll. Again, this isn't a secularist. This is the American church history professor at Wheaton College. And I'll guarantee you there was a time, at least in the past, when Wheaton College was a very conservative Christian college. And yet, let me read that again. He says, quote, in the Declaration of Independence, there are God-given rights, maybe, but inalienable rights means they are there before God. Let that sink in. This man is saying, by that statement, that God was created by whoever provided the inalienable rights before him. Here's another one. They have the reverend, which I always cross out. There are no reverends other than God. Richard Land, director of Christian Life Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention, says, quote, I myself have refrained from talking about Christian values and talk about a Judeo-Christian worldview, he says. That worldview presumes that there is such a thing as that worldview presumes that there is such a thing as absolute truth. Again, the Southern Baptist Convention. He goes on, it says, he and others say that pluralism and tolerance must be the way of modern America. And then later, secular humanism was in the root of the country from the beginning, says James Skillen, director of the Center for Public Justice, a nonpartisan think tank that has been described as taking a moderate approach to applying Christian principles to public policy. Listen again, he says, and this is from a moderate approach to applying Christian principles to public policy. He stated, secular humanism was in the root of the country from the beginning, says this man. That's moderate? That's a moderate approach to applying Christian principles? My goodness, anyone who has done any research at all into early American documents knows that is nothing but a flat-out lie. It's called revisionism. And it's happening in the secular world. It's happening in the religious world as much today as it's happening in the secularist world, because both have been infiltrated by Antichrist. By the way, not only do they want you to forget your true American history, your Christian American history, but also your Christian Israelite American history. My recently released book, God's Covenant People, Yesterday, Today, and Forever, fully documents not only America's Christian roots, but also America's Israelite roots. And they want to wipe them both out. Somebody doesn't want you to know about any of that. Somebody maybe like Esau Edom, who for generations has been trying to steal back the birthright and the blessings from Jacob Israel. I'll guarantee they don't want you to know your history. Could that also be why there's so much anti-white bias in America today as well? Wilmot Robertson documents how American history is being rewritten in an attempt to write the white man out of it, or at least to minimize his contributions. In The Dispossessed Majority, which is again also available through this ministry now, on pages 283 and 284, Wilmot Robertson writes this. He says, there are just as many white as black organizations on the lookout for, quote, racial slights, quote unquote, I should say, in courses and textbooks which do not elaborate fully on minority contributions to American history or persecutions of minorities abroad. At their insistence, which often borders on outright coercion, many such textbooks have been rewritten and even more have been replaced. Concurrently, public educational facilities have been put at the disposal of minority groups for research projects highly critical of majority institutions. Although minorities generally supported the British or were neutral in the War of Independence, a reading of recently published school and college texts would indicate that without minority assistance, Americans might now be swearing allegiance to Queen Elizabeth II. Crispus Attucks has become an important figure in American history. So important that an illustrated child's story of colonial times published in 1969 gives him more space than George Washington. Chaim Solomon, a Polish-born commission merchant, is another recently discovered minority, quote-unquote, hero of American independence and has been awarded an article under his own name in the Encyclopedia Britannica, although he was more than once welcomed behind British lines. Chaim Solomon, a Jew, was indeed considered at that time probably to be a spy. Not for us, but for them. Also, he goes on the other hand, those Negroes in the War of Independence who supplied British warships off the southern coast and who remained on board as volunteers are seldom featured in this quote-unquote new history. End of Wilmot Robertson's quote. The same is also happening in Britain as well today. And why not? It's the same people. It's the same thing, the same designs, the same enemies have the same designs against the same people. Here's an article I have from, it's an Associated Press, I don't have what paper it comes from, but it's entitled, How to Teach British History. Now, in this article, I won't read the whole article, but it basically tells us the same thing. Subtitled, Some Historians Say Minorities Need to Be Included. I won't read it, it basically tells us the same thing that Wilmot Robertson just provided us. But I do want to point out in this article that in this article, what I believe is the real reason for revisionism is inadvertently revealed. Listen to just part of it. It says, local schools have adapted to the cultural changes. In Bradford, where 53 of the 231 schools have non-white majorities, students learn a little of everything. Tawny Ecker's children attend Birkby School in Kirklees, suburban Bradford, where, quote, just about every ethnic festival is celebrated, end of quote. And then it says, quote, within a quote, it's wonderful, she said. They come back and tell you the stories about various gods and all of that. That indeed is the bottom line. Why there is this push against the white man? Because they know who the white man's God is. And they know he is the one and only real God. Now, if you don't believe that there's an agenda against the Celto-Saxon man today, I encourage you just go to your local movie theater and see if it's not true. I dealt with that a couple of years ago in a letter entitled Dances with Wolves Propaganda. Let me read it to you again. It says, I wrote, Don't miss Dances with Wolves, now showing in Torrington, Wyoming. Certainly a masterpiece of filmmaking in our time, as has been attested to by the fact of its being nominated for 12 Academy Awards. Great acting, great scenery, a great soundtrack, etc., and a masterpiece of propaganda. Go see it, but don't take your children unless you want them to hate being white. Some, I'm sure, will call me racist for having the audacity to make such a remark, but if they do, it just goes to show how well the propaganda machine has worked in its job of brainwashing. Why is it all right for a black man to be pro-black? Why is it okay for an Indian to stand up for his people? Why is it commendable for a Mexican-American to defend his race? And why is it racist for a white man to do the same for his? There is no question that individual white men and women have participated in their share of injustices, as have individuals from other races as well, but this has been the exception rather than the rule. But you would never know that by going to movies such as Dances with Wolves. Let me ask you, if you are white, when was the last time you or your children came away from a movie proud to be white? I would venture to say that you can't recall the time. Why? I think it's about time that someone takes a stand for the white race, if not for our generation, then at least for the next. White and proud of it, Ted R. Wyland Mitchell. You know, it's getting so bad that even editorials in liberal newspapers are showing up belittling what's going on in this same regard. I have another article that was sent to me from the Milwaukee Sentinel Tuesday, May 18th, 1993, that's entitled How the West Was Lost, Debunks Pioneering Myths. Let me read just part of it. It says, If you grew up thinking that famous Indian fighter Kit Carson was a hero, the new cable television documentary How the West Was Lost. Anybody see that? I didn't either. I didn't see it either, and from the sounds of it, I don't think I missed anything. Again, it says, If you grew up thinking that famous Indian fighter Kit Carson was a hero, the new cable television documentary, How the West Was Lost, wants to give you a new politically correct view. White men haven't been bashed this bad out west since the Battle of Little Bighorn. A little bit later he writes, if you have a portrait of John Wayne on your living room wall, drape black crepe over it before you watch this. The historical consultant for this one-sided show is Robert M. Utley, former National Park Service historian whom Wayne would certainly classify as a hostile witness. The nicest thing that Utley has to say about James H. Carleton, a U.S. Army general who subjugated the Navajo, is that he was, quote, within a quote, autocratic, abrasive, tyrannical, arrogant, dictatorial, end of quote, within a quote. The World Book Encyclopedia describes Kit Carson, who did most of Carleton's fighting for him, as, quote, within a quote, brave, gentle, honest, and wise, end of quote, within a quote. The Encyclopedia Britannica speaks of Carson's, quote, within a quote, reputation for bravery, loyalty, and devotion to duty, and his fairness and sympathy for the plight of the Indian, end of quote, within a quote. But in the jaundiced view of Utley, Kit Carson was an illiterate, uneducated, old mountain man, period. White male bashing reaches an epic level in this six-hour How the West was Lost. All the Indians are presented as pastorally perfect, all the whites as predatory and vile. The only new things mentioned that whites brought to the tribes are diseases such as cholera, whooping cough, smallpox, and measles. No mention that out of the barrel of the white man's guns came modern life with all its conveniences and complexities. Viewers who think that Washington should stop calling its football team the Redskins and Atlanta should drop the name Braves for its baseball team may welcome How the West Was Lost as a necessary correction to most Western histories. But anyone looking for a fair and balanced account of what happened on the white man's westward march should turn their eyes elsewhere. And I have to applaud Lee Winfrey for getting that into the paper. At the same time, even though some have begun to see through what's happening, don't think that all this propaganda isn't having its effect. Let me just give you one example, and this is a true story. A supervisor in an oil industry service company was confronted with the problem of what to do with an employee who tested positive in a random drug test. To be sure he could discharge the offender without getting the company involved in a plethora of civil rights lawsuits, the supervisor called the company's law firm to seek professional advice. Here are the lawyer's questions and the supervisor's response, or supervisor's answers. Is the employee a male? Yes. Is he Caucasian? Yes. Under 40 years old? Yes. Is he handicapped? No. Is he Protestant? Yes. Lawyer's advice, do anything you want. He has no rights. That's found in the World Oil Magazine, January 1992. True story. Now let there be no doubt, someone is out to destroy our history. Why? Because someone with a non-Israelite, non-American, non-Christian agenda knows our history is what we are, or is at least what we should be. And very well might inspire us to be what we once were at an earlier date. And I'll guarantee you they don't want that ever to happen. Another way our history is being lost is by the redefining of our language. The wordsmiths, or I should probably better put it, the word manipulators, have done a great job of taking words which were pregnant with meaning and reducing them to meaningless platitudes. Let's just take one word, for example, freedom. Will anybody deny that what freedom meant to those who wrote the Declaration of Independence back in 1776, that freedom meant to those men, that what freedom meant to those men is something altogether different from how our present government and general populace would describe it today? As S.L. Mooney so well put it in an article. He wrote it this way, quote, the strength of character and high virtue of the Pilgrims, Puritans, and Founding Fathers is completely lost to most Americans, who are convinced that they live in a quote-unquote free land on little more evidence than that they freely, quote-unquote freely, elect their bureaucrats from among the Democrats or Republicans and quote-unquote freely select their worldview from the offerings of ABC, NBC, and CBS, end of quote, which all give you the same menu to choose from, whether it be Republican or Democrat or whether it be ABC, NBC, or CBS. He later wrote this, "The masses stare blank-faced into their television sets as propagandist after propagandist repeats platitudes about our great and quote-unquote free land, and hardly anyone perceives it as lies since men with badges heretofore have not interfered with their choice of channels." End of quote. How true, and yet how sad. You know, America has in the past and is today often called a free country or the land of the free. But are we as free now as we were in the past? Are we any freer at this point in history than those nations that we describe as enslaved? Our people have been led to believe that we are, but only because the definition of freedom has been slowly altered over time. Don't forget, Americans have prided themselves as being free as they look down their noses at communist Russia, while at the very same time, all 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto were being practiced right here in America. You see, the language distortionist called it democracy, when in fact it was communism all along. In 1897, one of the stated goals of the elders of Zion was to change the meaning, to destroy specifically the word freedom. Listen to Protocol 3, Article 20. It says, "The word freedom brings out the communities of men to fight against every kind of force, against every kind of authority." Ellipsis. "For this reason, we, when we come into our kingdom, shall have to erase this word from the lexicon of life as implying a principle of brute force which turns mobs into bloodthirsty beasts." End of quote. And once again, isn't that exactly what's been happening here in America? Today's champions of freedom are labeled as extremists, as radicals, and usually a whole lot worse. Just bloodthirsty beasts. Because they want freedom. Only because they want freedom. Again, it's unbelievable to see the fulfillment of those protocols that are happening daily before us. The word freedom has not only changed, though, in the secular world, but it has also changed in the religious or Christian world as well. Maybe I should just leave it at religious or changed in the churches. David Davidson put it this way, "I think we as Americans need to turn back and look at something, the changing of the definition of the word freedom. The biblical definition of the word freedom means to be free under law. Freedom in the Bible means to be restrained from doing that which is wrong, but left alone to do that which is right. In American churches today, freedom is defined as just being left alone to do whatever comes into my mind. As society changes, what was wrong yesterday is right today. And so freedom moves upon a sea of relativity. To be free indeed, however, there are some things you can't do because they are not of the truth and are inconsistent for a disciple of the Lord to do. Only the Word of God can tell you how to be free. Liberty and biblical freedom are synonymous. Liberty is a condition of people under law that maximizes all their potential, keeps them safe, makes them prosperous, and defends them from their enemies. That is biblical freedom." Again, well put. Today's churches are defining freedom as freedom from law, when in fact, biblical Christianity is freedom through law. Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not talking about freedom from sins, which is only available through Yeshua the Christ and His plan of salvation, which, by the way, is also being redefined by most of Christendom today, making it null and void. But I'm not talking about salvation when I'm talking about the freedom I just mentioned, but rather the freedom, the liberty of the Christian walk after being set free through the atoning sacrifice of Yeshua the Christ. Freedom by law, not freedom from law. That is freedom through God's law, not man's. Because there isn't any freedom in man's laws. Kelly McNally put it this way, "This country used to go to God in prayer for that which we needed. Now, in order to be free, quote-unquote free, we have to do the following sort of ritual and prayer to the state. At birth, we are issued a birth certificate and a social security number. To get married, we get a marriage license. To work, we get a business license, social security number, and pay income taxes. To play, there is a boat, trailer, RV, motorcycle registration. To travel, we get driver's license, auto registration, and proof of insurance. And the quote-unquote God sends his angels in black and white vessels to make sure we do it right. To learn, we are instructed to attend public schools. To hunt, we get a hunting license. To fish, we get a fishing license and a boat registration. To own property, we pay a yearly property tax. To build a house, we get a building permit. To be safe, we are forced to get insurance. And for self-defense, we get our defense weapons registered. End of quote. Doesn't sound like freedom to me at all. That isn't the freedom, by the way, that our founding fathers in this country had in mind. I will guarantee you, we are not as free today as we were in the past. Why? Even though our people still think it, we are. But it's only because freedom has been redefined. It's become a meaningless platitude. That means nothing. That I just read is certainly not freedom, neither by biblical standards nor by our founding fathers' standards. Again, freedom has simply been redefined, as has such words as patriotism and independence and even the word Christianity itself. Whereas it was once just Christianity, it is now being called Judeo-Christianity with the goal in mind to make it just Judeo. It's a redefinition process. So, by just the redefining of words, our history can be lost as well. I shouldn't say can be lost. It is being lost as well. Another way our true history is being robbed from us is by secularists and preachers alike, separating patriotism from religion, that is Christianity. When in fact, in American history, the two are inseparable. You cannot separate the true. And any patriot today, any so-called patriot today, who thinks he can be a patriot without Christianity, he's just as far-fetched as the other side is. Because the two are inseparable. You cannot be a true patriot without being Christian. Yet many churches today are separating the two, with the inevitable result being a quote-unquote Christian society that's so heavenly-minded it's of no earthly good, or so present-minded so future-minded it is of no present good. A quote-unquote Christian society, which could care less about our early American roots and the price which was paid to secure America's liberty, is simply declaring that our history, our heritage, is unimportant. And as a result, our country, our government, is being, or I should say has been, turned over to the Antichrist, without as much as a finger being raised in the struggle. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood in this message. I do believe that July 4th, 1776 was a great day in American history. A day which should never be forgotten, nor should the price that was paid ever be minimized or devalued or underestimated. However, I do not look back on that day as some quote-unquote patriots do. Indeed, it was a great day. However, as a Christian preacher, I look back upon it not as a day or a standard to return to, but rather a day to build upon. I'm not for returning to man's best shot at heaven on earth. His best shot hasn't measured up. I mean, look where it's gotten us. But instead, I'm aiming for God's perfect standard or His kingdom based solely upon His laws, His perfect laws, which will result in His will on earth, His will on earth, as it is in heaven already. Because without His kingdom, without His laws, and most importantly, without Christ, true freedom will continue to escape the grasp of even those who claim to be freedom's greatest champions. They'll never get it unless we return even further back than July 4th, 1776, or unless we just use that as something to build upon. Let us not allow, as a result, time, the revisionists, the word manipulators, or the Judeo-Christian passive futurists to have their way with us, lest we forget our Christian American history and the price that was paid for our liberty. But also let us go even further back, lest we forget our Christian Israel heritage, which will return us not just to a man-made constitution, but rather to a God-inspired kingdom here on earth. In that light, let us heed the words found in Jeremiah 6 and 16, where it says, "Thus says Yahweh, stand by the ways, and seek and ask for the ancient paths, where the good way is, and walk in it, and you shall find rest for your souls." And Deuteronomy 32:7, which says, "Remember the days of old. Consider the years of all generations. Ask your father, and he will inform you, your elders, and they will tell you." And Isaiah 51:1-2, which says, "Listen to me, you who pursue righteousness, who seek Yahweh. Look to the rock from which you were hewn, and to the quarry or the pit from which you were dug. Look to Abraham, your father, and to Sarah, who gave you birth in pain." But of even greater importance, let's follow the instructions of Psalms 103, verses 1 through 5, where we find these words, "Bless Yahweh, O my soul, and all that is within me, bless His holy name. Bless Yahweh, O my soul, and forget none of His benefits, who pardons all our iniquities, who heals all your diseases, who redeems your life from the pit, who crowns you with loving kindness and compassion, who satisfies your years with good things so that your youth is renewed like an eagle." Lest we forget, let us go back to our Christian, Israelite, American foundations. Let's stand and we'll close in prayer. Our Heavenly Father, we are thankful to You this time, thankful for this day that's coming upon us tomorrow. It should indeed remind our people, Father, of the price that was paid. Father, the price that was paid by our founding fathers, our forefathers who sought for liberty. Yes, indeed, they fell short of bringing about the kingdom in its entirety. But Father, You let us look back and know that they began what they began needs to be built upon and be taken even further. Forgive us again where we've fallen short. Awaken our people, Father, through this day, Father, to their responsibility, not only to their forefathers, but Father, to You as well. Let this day remind our people, Father, of even the greater price that was paid much further back, the price of Your Son as He hung on the cross and shed His blood for the sake of true and real freedom and liberty and independence for His people. Let us return to that, Father. Let us build upon the foundations. Let us, Father, go forward with the truth and the call of liberty to our people, found in and only and through and by Yeshua the Christ and His sacrifice. We do praise You for this time now and glorify You and ask Your blessings upon this message wherever it will go, in and through and by Yeshua the Christ. Amen.